Okay. We are now going to discuss business combinations. Both the FESB and the ISB are engaged in a post-implementation review. Other standard setters, EPREC, ASBJ, and Italian standard setter have done research on goodwill. And we will start off with general presentations of the FESB and the ISB. Then we will talk about the research paper by ASBJ, EPREC, and OIC. And then we'll ask the FRC to discuss their findings on intangible assets. So, Tom, can I invite you to start with the FESB post-implementation review, whatever you may call it?
That's what we call it. Thanks, Hans.
Okay.
Our foundation does our post-implementation reviews, and they've done two post-implementation reviews that are related to this topic. One is of what was Statement 141R, which is the same as IFRS 3. That was completed in May of 2013. The general conclusions were that the statement resolved many practice issues, and the statement's requirements generally are understandable and can be applied as intended, and that investors generally find the information provided as being useful, but sometimes question the reliability of measurements. Areas of concern that came out of that PIR, which the two PIRs are very similar, I think, is that some concerns include measuring the fair value using our fair value measurement guidance as a challenge for certain assets and liabilities. Particularly measuring the fair value of contingent consideration was a key concern. And the third key concern was we have both standards have a very general definition of what a business is. And deciding what an asset versus a business is can be very challenging. And since the definition is so general, almost anything can be viewed to be a business, or at least that's the finding. Our foundation also did a post-implementation review of fair value measurements in February of 2014. The conclusions were that it achieved the expected benefits, that it provides investors with decision useful information, and that certain requirements are difficult to apply. In the absence, for example, of observable markets, particularly for private entities, and that there's ongoing costs to comply that are significant, primarily related to external valuation professionals and fees, and some of the demands made in the auditing environment to be able to get measures that justify measures. Our response was to those two PARs at this point is that we've added a project to our agenda to try to begin thinking about clarifying the definition of a business or distinguishing business from assets. There was a PCC, our private company council, that advises us about alternatives within US GAAP for private companies, developed a project on intangible assets in a business combination, both goodwill and identifiable intangibles, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Our emerging issues task force, which is similar to the IFRS implementation committee, just put something out on pushdown accounting. One of the issues that came out of business combinations in the financial instruments area was fair valuing loans in a business combination and why we wouldn't be having an allowance or an expected credit loss recognized on that. And we're addressing that within our impairment project. And we're reviewing fair value disclosures, given that the volume that they're in the financial statements. But related to the particular issues for today, let me describe the goodwill alternative that we have for private that we've approved for private companies. The general view of the users of private companies is goodwill amortization is not worth much, even though they didn't have it anymore. The impairment's kind of limited in value, but it does have some confirmatory value. But not also much that if they have access to management that they necessarily think that they need to be measuring it precisely because the value isn't in the number. It's in saying there was an impairment. So what we permitted is they've decided to amortize goodwill over 10 years or less if they can justify that the assets got a lesser period, and to apply a simpler impairment test that's based on a on a triggering event, not every period evaluation, elected to be performed not at the reporting unit level, but at the reporting unit level or the entity level. And just like IFRS, it's a one-step test rather than what we had as a two-step test. Since this paper was written, we had another private company council meeting, and they've decided to propose to the board, and we haven't seen whether the board's going to endorse that or not, for certain identifiable and tangible assets that they would not have to be recognized. And those are customer-related intangibles that are not capable of being sold or licensed separately, and non-competition agreements would not have to be recognized separately. I think the thought process is those are some of the most difficult of identifiable intangibles to measure. A lot of outside money and counsel to be able to go through that process. And if they really can't be sold separately or measured very well, perhaps what you end up doing then is not recognizing them and putting them in goodwill. To the extent that they exist, they would be disclosed. And then private company users could ask management with access about more information about those particular assets. Now, certainly of the customer-related intangibles would not qualify as not being able to be sold, okay? Because if you think about certain mortgage servicing rights or commodity supply contracts or core deposits for banking institutions, they are sold separately at times, and so they would still be recognized. Finally, we decided when we heard about the goodwill issue for the private company community that that's not just an issue for the private company community. So the FASB, after the PCC finished their document, their guidance that would say there's an alternative to amortize it 10 years and once in a simplified impairment, to see if we ought to also be doing that for public companies. And so we had a long discussion about alternatives that are like those in everyone else's papers today, about amortizing goodwill, direct write-off of goodwill, or just a simplified impairment test. And the board discussed that extensively with preliminary leanings. At this point, at least the vote was 4 for simplified impairment, 3 for amortization of goodwill with impairment. But we decided not to go out and proceed with those decisions, awaiting the ISB's preliminary implementation review of IFRS 3 to see where you were going to be going with that particular project, whether the issues would be the same or not, and if the issues are the same, whether we could try to keep a converged standard converged, and so we are waiting to see that. We also have in our impairment test a qualitative test before you have to go through impairment for goodwill that says if you can demonstrate that it's not more likely than not that it's impaired, you can stop all the analysis. And we were wanting to wait to see, as we came out of the bust of our cycle, whether or not that qualitative test was simplifying impairment significantly. And we're finding evidence that right 2 years ago, the qualitative test was used by about 30% of registrants. It's now up into the 40-45% range. So it's behaving like you'd expect when things get better, that it's not more likely than not you're going to have an impairment in better times. And that's, for us, some of us, a consideration as to whether a simplified impairment test is the right way to go or whether we ought to do impairment and amortization and an impairment test. I'll tell you, through the time period since we've had that vote, I was one of the four that said simplified impairment. And so I was the fourth one out of the 4-3. But in reading papers and discussing things with people around the table here, we've been influenced by work by the ISB, the ASBJ, the FRC, FRAG, the OIC. I become convinced that I'd be leaning towards an amortization solution and simplified impairment. So we're now at the point where we can learn from what your PIR said, and we'd hope that we could consider moving forward to try to do something to keep this converged.
Okay. Leonardo?
Yes, thank you. I think that we have very similar comments on a post-implementation review of IFRS 3. If we go to slide 6 of the presentation, we can see that the first issue is a definition of a business. And so, as already mentioned by Tom, this is an implementation issue because many think that the definition is too broad. This is particularly relevant in some industries, such as real estate and extractive industries. We receive two suggestions. One suggestion is to work on the definition, provide more guidance on what is a business and what is not a business. Another suggestion is to try to reduce or eliminate the existing accounting differences between business combination and asset acquisition. If we go to slide 7, we can see another similar issue. It's fair value measurement. Generally, users agree that fair value measurement is the best approach to measure asset acquired and liability assumed in a business combination. However, there are implementation challenges, especially in measuring tangible assets, such as non-contractual intangible assets for which there is no active market, and intangible assets in the early stage of development. Also, contingent liabilities and contingent consideration are very difficult to measure because it's difficult to estimate the probability of the future event that should occur. Another similar issue is in slide 8 and is the separate recognition of intangible assets. On this one, we had mixed view from investors because some investor says that information provided by intangible asset is more useful than information provided by goodwill. Others says they say no, this they don't trust in the evaluation of this intangible asset, and so they say these intangible assets are not useful for their analysis. Users are also mixed on the non-amortization of goodwill. The main comments received are summarized in slide 9. Also in this case, some investor says non-amortization of goodwill is useful because they can assess stewardship, because they can see if an acquisition is successful or if is overpaid. Other investor says no, the impairment test is not effective because 2 or 3 years after the business combination, the business acquired is integrated in the operation of the acquirer, and so the impairment test doesn't work. In slide 10, we have a summary of our academic literature review. We can say that many studies provide evidence in support of non-amortization of goodwill because these studies show that the amount of the goodwill recognized in the financial statement in accordance with IFRS 3 is positively associated with share prices, and goodwill impairment expenses is negatively associated with share price. This means that larger goodwill amounts are associated with higher share prices, while larger impairment expenses are associated with lower share prices. This information is interpreted as useful information for investors. Another issue, this one I think is not mentioned by Tom, is step acquisition and loss of control. Many users think that the gain on the remeasurement of the fair value of the previously held interest is a non-recurring gain that is not part of the performance of the entity, and so usually investors does not consider this gain in their analysis. Some investors suggest to recognize this gain and other comprehensive income. Other investors suggest not to remeasure the previously held interest. Finally, in slide 13, we have the next steps of the project. This slide is not up to date because yesterday the board discussed the summary of the comment received and decided that we got enough information to prepare a feedback statement. So we will present a summary of this feedback statement in a future board meeting, I think October. This is a summary of the comment received. Then we have questions that we do after.
The questions are here. So which is the next presentation?
SBJ.
So thank you for giving us an opportunity to present the joint project conducted by the SBJ, EFRAG, and OIC. And I'm Tomo Sekiguchi, a board member of the SBJ. And the person next to me is Tommaso Fabi from OIC. And in carrying out our project, we formed a research group, and the research group includes the also includes the Philip Bocoli from IFRAG and Malcolm Merritt Matti from OSC. And although the SBJ, IFRAG, and OSC have reviewed this content during the process of the creating the discussion paper, the views in the discussion paper are the research groups only. So please just acknowledge that. And we also like to acknowledge the special appreciation to the Indian Accounting Standards Centers because they provided a very good input to us. And based on the research we carried out, we published a discussion paper in July this year with a comment period 20th of September. And so we would like to provide some high-level summary of the comment we have received so far toward the end of the presentation. But in the interest of time, we would like to keep the presentation as brief as possible. So please go on to the page 2 of the slide. The purpose of the project, we actually started the project, the research project, back in 2012. And at that time, there was a big discussion about whether impairment test was appropriate in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, etc. And based on the background, we conducted the survey to the interested party, including users, preparers, and auditors, and academics. And based on the input we have received from the survey, we decided to pursue the other approaches and other initiatives, and to explore the possible solutions to address the problems we have heard from the survey. And these are summarized in the page 2. We identified the possible solutions by way of the three approaches. The first is to changing the accounting requirement of goodwill, including the reintroduction of amortization. And secondly, improving the requirement for the impairment testing. Thirdly, we explored whether improvement could be made to the disclosure requirement currently specified in IS 36. In page 3, we summarize the research group's preliminary views stated in the discussion paper. Specifically, the research group thought that it would be appropriate to reintroduce the impairment and amortization approach for the goodwill, because on balance it can be applied with a reasonable level of verifiability and reliability. Yet at the same time, we thought that there are areas where we can improve into the impairment testing and disclosure requirement. And nevertheless, we as a research group believe that these recommendations are not mutually exclusive, and some or all of the recommendations can be put in place in altogether or in package. And the page 5 to page 8, page 10 are the summary of what we have explored and what we recommended in the discussion paper. As you see in page 5, we have explored four alternative approaches with regard to the goodwill. And first, we explored and sought the discernible element approaches. We thought that it's maybe conceptually most appropriate, but in fact, it's very difficult to implement. So we thought that it's from the viewpoint of the practicability, it's not an approach that we could explore. And secondly, we explored whether we could take approach to require immediate write-off to whether to equity or to the profit or loss. But again, we thought that this might give rise to a serious conflict with the notion that goodwill should be an asset. We considered whether goodwill could be is not an asset or not, but we decided that in light of the conceptual framework, we thought the goodwill meets the definition of asset. And especially with regard to the write-off, immediate write-off to equity, we thought that it also gave rise to the problem with the conflict of the definition of income and expense. So we thought that it's not the approach that we could explore further. And lastly, we explored whether impairment and amortization approach would be appropriate. And as I said earlier, we thought that this might be an approach that we could explore further. And page 6 is the summarized our views on the amortization and impairment approach. And we thought that the impairment and amortization approach could address the concern about capitalization of internally generated goodwill, and secondly, could mitigate the risk of delaying the recognition of impairment losses, and thirdly, could still still require judgment in assessing the useful life of goodwill. But this, we thought that this is true for the other tangible asset or the other intangible asset as well. So these are some analysis we have performed. And page 7 and page 8 are the what we thought would be the appropriate way to set a requirement with regard to the amortization of goodwill. We first thought that we should have a general principle which is the sort of general guideline for the preparers to in exercising the sound judgment. But we also thought that application guidance that could support the general principle would be necessary. And so we suggested the specific general principle as well as the application guidance that support the general principles. And page 8 is the summary of the what we thought would be the appropriate general principle and application guidance, including the factors cost for the consideration. Page 9 is the other way of improving the current requirement, which is improving the IS 36, in other words, improving the impairment testing. We identified several areas for improvement, namely, the first one is the identification of cash generating unit. Second one is the input and methods to determine recoverable amount of CDUs. And thirdly, we thought that the improvement could be made to the discount rate, namely, in order to ensure the consistent application of the discounting. So these are the areas that we thought could be applied, improvement could be made in the area of the impairment testing. Page 10 is the summary of the the improvement could be made to the disclosure requirement. And first we first considered in light of the objective financial reporting, we thought that there should be the high level or robust disclosure requirements, and in order to support the disclosure requirement, we come up with the specific disclosure the area that could be improved for us for the disclosure requirement. And these are summarized in page 10 of the slide. And page 11 and 12 are the questions that we asked for to the respondents in the discussion paper. We asked the 5 questions, these questions relate to the 3 areas that we identified in the discussion paper as the area for improvement, namely the whether and how the amortization and impairment approach could be reintroduced to the current IFRS. And second, the impairment testing could be whether and how impairment testing could be improved. And third, whether and how the disclosure requirement could be improved, and these are the area that we asked to the constituents. But at the same time, we also asked the related issues, that is the intangible assets other than goodwill. Well, we focused, initially we focused on the goodwill, but in discussing the way to improve the requirement relating to the goodwill, we thought that there would be a kind of knock-on effect on the other areas, namely the whether and how the separation of intangible assets from goodwill could be modified, and secondly, whether the goodwill intangible asset with indefinite indefinite useful life could be maintained, even if the impairment and amortization approach would be introduced to the goodwill. So these are the areas that we asked to the constituents. And let me explain the high-level summary of what we have heard. So far, we have received 7 responses, including investor organization, business federation, and Big Four firm. And we are expecting some more to come. And let me briefly explain the summary of feedback. The first week, most respondents, or perhaps many respondents, supported the introduction of goodwill and impairment of goodwill amortization in addition to the impairment testing. And secondly, most respondents supported providing requirements and application guidance with regard to the amortization period that we struggle most in preparing the discussion paper. Thirdly, respondents expressed mixed views on proposed changes to the impairment testing. Some thought that it's a good idea, but some thought that it's not really necessary. Fourthly, the most respondents disagreed with or did not find that specific need of increasing disclosure requirement, especially given that the disclosure overall have been already a significant problem. And lastly, respondents expressed mixed views on whether to modify the requirement relating to the intangible asset. And so that we did in the discussion paper. And Tomaso, do you have anything to add?
No, I think, thank you, Tomaso. I think you said everything. I'm still receiving some letters now. The comment period has ended last week, but we're still receiving some letters, so we expect to have more comment letters in the following days. We also discuss what to extend some the comment period, because it was really short comment period we set, also because we wanted to this meeting and for the IFAS meeting with a sort of first understanding of what's what the comments are out there. So I think that we can update.
Roger?
Thanks, Hans. Well, I think at the FRC we'd heard anecdotal stories that analysts don't tend to value, I suppose, amortization of intangible assets, and they add it back when they get to their income projections. But that was anecdotal, so we thought we'd do a study. And we actually did a study of 27 either analysts or fund managers, or mostly on the buy side, to find out actually how they treat intangible asset amortization. I suppose not surprisingly, we found that most of them add it all back, to the extent that actually they add back all intangible amortization, even intangible amortization on, say, software. This is easier than trying to disentangle the various types of intangible asset amortization. And why that is, they don't really value that information. But what they would value is splitting amortization of intangibles into amortization of truly wasting intangibles, such as patents, where clearly they have a finite life, and amortization of intangible assets like such as customer lists, which don't obviously waste away, and in fact tend to be replaced by the current expenditure. So in fact, by the amortization tends to double count costs, because not only do you have the cost of replenishing those intangibles, you also have the amortization of the intangibles. So I think the people who spoke to us said At the moment, we just add it all back, and indeed, this is probably what preparers do in their non-GAAP measures anyway, to make it easier for the analysts. But actually, if you were to split these costs out, that would be more helpful to us. Now, in fact, very recently, I've had my attention drawn to Warren Buffett's 2013 letter to shareholders, which says, serious investors should understand the disparate nature of intangible assets, some truly deplete over time, whilst others in no way lose value. With software, for example, amortization charges are variable expenses. Charges against other intangibles, such as the amortization of customer relationships, however, arise through purchase accounting rules and are clearly not real costs. And I think probably that Warren Buffett letter more or less encapsulates what analysts have told us, that they don't regard these as real costs, and therefore they don't actually value the information. Now, I think we carried out the study, first of all, to find out whether the anecdotal evidence actually proven out by a more comprehensive survey. But secondly, because we are aware that, first of all, management don't look at these sorts of assets before they buy a company. Secondly, they spend quite a lot of money, first of all, in valuing these assets and then having the auditors audit the assets, but then actually use the information that comes out of it. So we do agree with the ISB's conclusions that users don't value this sort of information, and we would encourage the ISB to reconsider this when they're consider what to do with the...
What would we reconsider?
Whether or not to require the amortization going... Well, whether to value these intangible assets separately going forward.
Yeah. It would this also mean that if we were to reintroduce amortization of goodwill, that all users would do would add it right back?
That's a separate question. My personal view is that amortization of goodwill would just get added back, yes. Yeah, I mean, maybe
because that is even less tangible than customer relations, for example.
Yeah,
that's what they used to do, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
But in some respects,
why didn't they tell you? Because apparently, what did users tell you about your proposals?
Users, we met some in several circumstances. Also, always say what you heard in the IFRS 3 post implementation review, that you know. Goodwill impairment has a confirmatory value for users. We have never been told that goodwill impairment has any kind of predictive value, such as other figures in financial statement. So we struggle a lot, starting from this point. On the other hand, we have the cost of implementation. Of impairment tests for preparers and the fact that impairment tests always comes too late. So we discussed a lot where we can just improve impairment to solve these issues. Then at the end we concluded that the only way to retain this confirmative value in the financial statements and to address the cost for preparers for impairment is to combine impairment with amortization. That's I think the thinking we followed. I don't know if you.
One of the things we were struggling with when we thought about simplified impairment versus amortization and impairment was the issue as to whether amortization is useful. But then for some of us, we thought about the reason why amortization isn't useful is EBITDA. Depreciation is also added back. Should we be then deciding conceptually to say don't do depreciation and amortization and just impairment? And that causes us some pause. Are these wasting assets or not? And the impairment model is confounded in terms of good intangible or goodwill impairment because it's evaluating internally generated goodwill against the original. And the notion of amortization would say if the original goodwill is being replaced by internally generated goodwill, the original goodwill is going away.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But your point on are these depleting assets or not, I mean, with depreciation, most of them are depleting assets, but even then, the analysts, well, they're
adding
it take it back. So they don't really care whether it's a real using up of the asset or not, they just take it out and don't take any notice.
Well, the question is, why are they doing that? And I think it's because they're trying to get a certain sort of operating income measure, right?
Yeah, it's not their only method of analysis.
That's correct.
I would imagine that they think that payment of interest is important.
That's
take it away, but it's a real expense. So
But actually, if you look at what the analyst told us, they would actually value depreciating wasting intangible assets, which is actually like wasting plant, for example. So I think that's depreciation that Tom's talking about. I think actually some of the stuff which isn't clearly wasting, such as customer lists, is very similar to the residual goodwill. And I think if you started amortizing that, analysts would just add it back, because they say it's not clear to us that it's actually wasting at all.
Yeah, but they seem to add back wasting assets as well.
Well, they do at the moment, purely.
But to get to some sort of operating income. Yeah. But for the bottom line, I'm sure they will take that into account as well. But I think what Roger is saying, that even for the bottom line, they would take out the amortization charges.
Yeah. Yeah.
They would think it's worthless, period.
Yeah.
Indeed. Will you?
Yeah, thanks. I would like to spend 1 minute or two on the argument that an amortization and impairment system would mitigate the risk of delaying the recognition of impairment losses. We heard yesterday a survey of the academic literature, and there is ample evidence that the issue of timeliness of impairment recognition is a matter of enforcement, and that those jurisdictions which have strong enforcement, there is less a problem of timeliness or delay in recognition of impairment losses. So is it a conceptual problem, or is it really an enforcement problem, which I think is the case? Now, if you say that markets are a little bit, always ahead of the accounts, and that impairment losses are recognized in half-year accounts or quarterly reports or year-end reports, and the markets are always a bit ahead of it. Yes, of course. Markets have a price every day, and investors anticipate the economic situation. By definition, the impairment loss is recognized sometime after the markets have taken the economic situation into account. Does that mean it is not timely? For me, a non-timely recognition is if you wait a year or two after when it should have been recognized. I don't think that is the case, except in those jurisdictions where there is weak auditing, weak enforcement, weak corporate governance. So I'm not convinced about the argument about the mitigating effect. I would add to that it would happen only if you have a very, very quick amortization, a very short amortization period. If you amortize over 5 years, a goodwill, yes, maybe if you have a problem in year two, you have already 2/5 of the goodwill amount which have gone. But no one is proposing to return to a 5-year amortization, I hope, or I think. So the question is 10 years, 15 years, 20 years or more. Yes, but the economic cycles tend to shorten. Economic cycles tend to be 5 to 7 years. So if you made an investment, a large investment at the end of a cycle, the likelihood that your goodwill will be gone with amortization at the time you may have an impairment problem is very small. So I don't think amortization in principle is really a cure for the problem of recognition of impairments. It may in certain cases help, but only if you have a very quick amortization. And I don't think a quick amortization period will be acceptable to investors. They will add it back, because what does it mean? A large investment is gone over 5 years. What's the meaning of that? Why 10 years? Why 20 years? I remember the good old days when the US had 40 years, and in Europe we had 5 to 10, and everywhere.
50.
50, well, 40. I remember 40.
What did we have in Europe?
5 to 10, 20, and there was. So, and everyone was adding back and saying, anyway, it doesn't create any comparability, so let's forget it. So, I'm not really convinced about this argument.
Tom?
Yeah, I just like to respond to the Philip's comments in two ways. The first, you said that the impairment testing, if conducted rigorously or if enforced rigorously, could not lead to the situation where impairment losses could be delayed, and that you said. But I think we saw that it's true if the impairment testing compares the same thing. In other words, the current impairment testing compares the values at the end of the period, and the values at or the carrying amount of the goodwill or et cetera at the time of the business combination, and so there are inherently in calculation. The internal generated goodwill are inherently included in the calculation. So we are not comparing the same thing in the impairment testing. Therefore, in mechanism, I'm not really convinced whether impairment testing, if enforced rigorously, could not lead to the delay of the impairment losses, and that we described in the discussion paper. And secondly. Well, I think you somehow challenged our argument that the amortization period could be set as 10 to 20 years as a maximum with a rebuttable presumption. And let me explain the reason why we set that the such a recommendation. When we reviewed the academic research, we found that the common findings are that. The excess earnings diminishes over 5 to 10 year period, and so perhaps it may be true that the 5 to 10 period of amortization would be generally appropriate. But at the same time, we thought that we considered whether we should be prescribing the specific number of the amortization period or whether we would. Require the preparers to exercise professional judgment, and we went for the second, the latter way. And in doing so, we set out the maximum period of the amortization period, and therefore we thought that a little bit longer term, from the 5 years to 10 years, would be appropriate. And therefore, we thought that it may be appropriate to set 10 years to 20 years as a maximum period, so that. We can.
Isn't that a very long time for a company to burn back its acquisition costs?
Well, I mean,
that would be really bad investing,
I think. I took an argument, and maybe 20 years is maybe a too
long. I think 7 years is the. Don't earn your investment back in the additional amount you pay over fair value. Your expected synergy, if you don't earn that back in 7 years, you're not doing good business, I would say.
If I may just, I would stop speaking. After. The difficulty in the impairment test, which is to separate the original goodwill from the subsequently recreated goodwill, is a real one. We all accept it. But a system where you have impairment and amortization, or amortization impairment, has the same difficulty. You always have to separate the initial goodwill from the subsequently created goodwill. So I don't see how amortization solves that problem.
It reduces. At least it reduces, because you at least estimate the pattern of consumption of that asset, and you, determining this period, you allocate into this period of time. So at least it's an approximation, but it's probably you are recognized less internally generated goodwill than not amortizing. That's the way we discussed.
It may be particularly true. I don't think conceptually it's very strong.
I think at least... But
conceptually it's also not very strong to just let it sit there. I mean, because if it's true that, from what I understand about this, is that goodwill mainly consists of expected synergies. If those expected synergies pan out in the post-acquisition period, then your revenue should go up or your costs should go down, and you should have additional profit. If you recognize that additional profit and not at the same time depreciate the goodwill, then you're double counting. So I think there is a conceptual argument to be made that it should go. At a certain point, whether that makes whether it's not extremely subjective and gets into a lot of investors find that useful information is doubtful. I mean, at least the educated investor.
then you could still say, well, there are a lot of uneducated investors who do not add back, and you know, it is proper that the financial statements do show this depreciation of goodwill anyway, because not everybody is adding back intangibles. And from what I understand anecdotally in Japan, one of the appeals of IFRS is that you don't have to depreciate your goodwill. that's what a lot of Japanese companies like. And I also understand the original political deal around business combinations was, okay, we'll let go of pooling of interest, but then in return we get non-amortization of goodwill. Mm-hmm. That also gives some indication that the motivations were not all academic and noble.
That is not official. That is not written in the base for confidence.
So I find this a difficult one. Roger.
I think Hans, a number of us are aware of the political backdrop to this this deal. I mean, I agree with you. The problem is that goodwill comes from a number of different sources, and clearly where it relates to synergies, then an acquirer will pay more money to buy that company. Mm-hmm. That goodwill should be written off probably very quickly, perhaps over the next 5 years, because that's really when the synergies are clear, perhaps even 3 years. The problem is other goodwill might just relate to the ability of this business to earn higher returns than its cost of capital on its recognized assets. And some of that might be recognizable intangibles, some might not, actually. Some might just be some sort of general technology, which isn't even represented by patents. So you can't really very easily separate the bits of goodwill that should be amortized and the bits of goodwill that shouldn't be amortized. I don't think analysts would really trust the information anyway. They don't trust intangibles at the moment. So I don't know whether they trust this further allocation of goodwill, which is why I think it's easier to leave it unamortized. But I do think that there's very valuable recommendations in this joint report about impairment and how you would improve impairment. And I do think there's work to be done in that area.
Yes. On that very point, the interesting result of your survey is the goodwill would be replaced. Then the outcome of opinion is quite different. Some of the investors said, because goodwill replaced, and in order to replace the goodwill, the cost is recognized in the operation income. So therefore, if you amortize it, it will double charge. So you don't have to recognize it. You don't have to amortize it. That's one opinion. The other opinion, with the same fact that goodwill is replaced, is goodwill itself will be disappear. So therefore, you have to recognize the amortization. And at the same time, you are expensing. However, you are creating internally generated goodwill. And normally, in the normal circumstances, you wouldn't recognize the asset of internally generated goodwill. So therefore, you should amortize it. So there are completely opposite opinion. So I found it very interesting.
I think that second point of view is more of a standard assessor's point of view. I think analysts look at this purely from performance, and mm-hmm. so they don't particularly value double counting of charges in the income statement. Mm. So I think this idea about internally generated goodwill as against purchased goodwill is lost on them. Mm-hmm. They're just trying to say, hey, we only want the charge once. You know, either we get the amortization, or you capitalize the cost of replacing that, but you don't put both to the income statement.
Yeah, I take your point. The problem is if you are creating internally generated goodwill, which is not acquired goodwill, you anyway do not recognize it on the asset side. But on the other hand, if it is replacing to the internal generated goodwill, eventually your expense is indirectly capitalized. I mean, to keep the original goodwill as it is,
yes.
And pay the expense, and because you are not amortize it, keep it. And although it is replaced, but you do not amortize, so eventually you are capitalizing it. So, yeah, it's a kind of difficult. judgment to answer which is right.
Liesl?
I would have argued something along the lines of Roger, at least partly. I think a number of people would rather focus on IFRS 3, but even Tom mentioned impairment testing. Mm-hmm. And I think there's so much, almost, I'm inclined to say, misgiving about the impairment tests being extremely costly, being very judgmental, being very much in the focus of regulators too. Again, as everyone says, one should focus on IFRS 3, but then the intangibles too point in that direction. And as you said, that there are valuable recommendations, I think really going a bit more for IS 36 might get a bit of mileage.
So rather than the amortization and the impairment approach,
well,
go for an improvement of the impairment.
Not proposing, I assume, just amortization. You'll always have amortization and impairment.
Right.
Definitely, because if once you go beyond 5 years, you cannot go without impairment. I mean, if you net it off against reserves, you don't need impairment testing. But once you go beyond 5 or 10 years, you do definitely need impairment testing.
Yeah.
And so as you need impairment testing anyway, I think that's where it could be a helpful investment in getting that better, more palatable, maybe even better in its results. Because the other debate between amortization and non-amortization, you're not going to come to a common ground in the near future anyway.
Clement?
If we cannot decide on the theoretical justification or conclusion on whether amortization and impairment would be the right way, because of all the reasons I raised earlier, another way to look at amortization might be is a way to get rid of the inconsistency over time, because at least, you know, for those people who are not capitalizing goodwill through amortization, that goodwill will be gone after a certain period of time, and at least it go back to the level playing field.
We've got caught up in the academic argument as to whether amortization or impairment's the right thing. I think the loudest message we've received in the PIR is that the process of trying to get a precisely correct measure of impairment is too costly for the benefits that are achieved. And the process of pushing down and remeasuring purchase price and doing allocations and everything else for a number that doesn't matter, just the fact that they impaired, would suggest, I think, that regardless we have to think about impairment. And then we can get caught up in whether or not when we think about impairment, whether we want to go into the exercise of rethinking amortization versus simplified impairment or just simplified impairment. That was the struggle we were having as a board both ways. I don't particularly buy into this notion of double counting. Mm-hmm. Because if you have to incur expenses to create goodwill throughout, and what you do is you acquire the benefits of goodwill on the outside, that means you're catching up and paying for someone's past costs for generating that and seeing what's going to happen in the future. Mm-hmm. Putting those costs in as an asset now don't make any sense if what you're going to do in future generated goodwill is expensive. It might suggest that you expense the goodwill that you pay at day one. That would be a direct write-off. I don't see a double charge coming forward here. I think you continually incur costs to create the synergies of collectively working together. You just happen to have delayed it in an acquisition because someone else had done it for you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're projecting what it would be in the future.
Do you think if you would go for a maximum amortization period of 10 years and with the possibility of doing it in a shorter period,
yes,
would there still be a lot of impairment going on in practice?
I think
it might disappear.
And that's the advantage of dealing with the complexity of impairment problem by doing amortization, but I don't think that's the reason to do amortization.
No, and I think that investors would
find that a big loss, because they are telling us and the academicians that and also the academic analysis of stock market reactions give very clear indications that impairment has even predictive value. So and confirmatory value. So if you go for an amortization approach that in practice will get rid of impairment, that might be a high price to pay.
Linda?
Yeah, just to add to the discussion, real life example from my past life where we did the work to find out that we had an impairment, but we couldn't get it done before we had to report our numbers. And one of the reasons we couldn't get the impairment finalized is because we couldn't settle on some discount rates. So just to weave in an earlier discussion that was acceptable to both management and the auditors. So we found ourselves in the unenviable position of doing a press release that says, we have determined that we have an impairment, but we've been unable to quantify it for purposes of this report, and we'll do it in the next report. Not a happy outcome. However, it does support the notion that the mere presence of an impairment is informative because, you know, it was reflected in the stock price. And when we actually then did the next press release to say, okay, it's this much, the market had already factored in the fact that there was an impairment. So just a real life example about complexity.
Roger. Can I give another real life example? I'm chairman of an audit committee which eventually decided to impair some goodwill. Now, the previous year, we were close to impairment, but not quite there. So, under critical accounting policies, we said, we've looked at this, we're not quite there yet, but we're around about that. We're getting there.
We're getting worse and worse.
Just wait. and then next year, we impaired, because about the business further deterioration. Now actually it's gone around the other way, but you're not allowed to reverse that. But I do think this is important information to the marketplace. You know, the fact that you're close to it, the fact that you're now below it, so therefore you're impairing. And just amortization, that has no meaning that to the marketplace. So I would agree with you.
Yeah, I just like to comment on your comment on the negative association between impairment loss and the share prices. And well, I think it's true that there is an association between the impairment, the existence of impairment losses and share prices. But it doesn't mean that the impairment losses come in a timely manner, or impairment loss actually come late. The fact that there is just a correlation between impairment loss and the share prices, but based on our discussion with stakeholders, it's probably the tendency that impairment loss came later than originally expected. And so, although I take your point, but it doesn't mean that there is a timely recognition of impairment loss.
I agree. That can still be the case. But yes, Tom.
And I would also clarify that we are not proposing any kind of fixed number of years of useful life of goodwill. I mean, we're starting from a principle that goodwill in our thinking should be amortized. Then we try to develop or to suggest that the standard setter to develop an application guidance that starts from a concept that we think is more coherent with the consumption that I described before, that is, the payback period that any kind of manager determine at the very at the initial recognition of business combination, and if it's not reliable or possible or whatever, there are other kind of indicators that can help to determine kind of useful life, and then at the end there is we arrive at a fixed number of years that can be determined based on the studies on evidences. So we are not proposing a fixed number. That's fine.
Yeah. So one of the questions that we ask you is what are the most critical urgent issues from this PIR that we should consider as part of our agenda setting process. I suppose that we just discussed one or two. Yeah. Clement?
Yeah, on the critical issues that we should be looking at, I think we talked about, you know, the amortization and impairment. The definition of business definitely is a big thing that we need to look at critically.
Definition
of business.
Yeah.
And BCUCC, the business combination under common control.
Okay. That reminds me when we tried to find what a reporting was, and we came to the conclusion that that was an entity that reports.
Conceptual.
Well, the definition of business, because it's come up again and again in all sorts of contexts, and it seems to be with variations between different perspectives. Then the intangibles and the unit of intangibles and so forth. The contingent consideration, well, it's been up with IFRIC on a number of occasions, and you haven't made a lot of headway there yet. Goodwill, sure. And that's about it. The business combinations under common control, I must say, in our area of the world, people do have questions, absolutely clearly, and those who have the most questions should seem to be rather the auditors than the preparers.
Just to echo that, it's the main concern from our point of view is definition of business, and perhaps just to drill down a bit, the really key thing is to what extent you're acquiring processes, or you're acquiring something that your own processes can be used in conjunction with. So the extent to which you have to be acquiring something that includes not just assets and liabilities, but some sort of process for applying them, that seems to be the key area for us in terms of the definition that's causing us problems.
In addition to what Liesl already said, I mean, the other point that he's raised is the one that was also in Leonardo's presentation about the accounting for the gains on the investment that you already held prior to the business combination.
Okay. Anna?
Yes, apart from the definition of business, also maybe we should focus on the asymmetries between the acquisition of an asset and a business combination, for example, related to acquisition costs or contingent consideration or deferred tax assets and liabilities, which are different when you acquire an asset and when you do a business combination. Maybe we should have a reflection on these asymmetries and try to find out if they should stay as they are. And of course, also impairment and amortization of goodwill.
Well, in responding to the ISP's request for information, we carried out a number of one-to-one meetings with the preparers, users, and auditors. And based on that, we found that there are three areas that require particular attention. The first, of course, is the amortization, and I think it's quite evident, so I wouldn't repeat that. And secondly, the issue about whether and how the intangible assets should be separated from the rest of goodwill is a matter that stakeholders identified as a matter for urgent consideration. Thirdly, whether to reconsider the accounting treatment relating to the step acquisition and loss of control. These are the areas that stakeholders are very keen on. And in our meetings, a number of users stated that the gain or loss on step acquisition or either step acquisition or loss of control must be disregarded in the analysis. And so these are the areas that we have identified as a matter of requiring urgent consideration.
First of all, with regard to the impairment only approach or amortization and impairment approach for the goodwill, in China we got different views. So many prepares they prefer the amortize and impairment approach, but many users they favor the impairment only approach. So I currently have no clear answer to this question. We need to explore further. The second, I supported Clement's view that in China we have a lot of business combination and common control. So we hope this issue could be resolved as soon as possible at the board level. And this, and I also support that we needed more clear definition of the business. And thirdly is that we also think that contingent liabilities and contingent consideration need to be also are two important issues need to be addressed clearly.
There's one thing that occurs to me out of all these suggestions, and that is when we do post-implementation reviews, which are going to be an ongoing feature, how much are we looking forward to actually turning the standard right upside down?
Yeah.
And starting again, and how much do we just want to tinker? So in relation to this one, I mean, amortization, I guess, could be done quite easily. It's not complicated technically. And fixing impairment or making impairment simpler might be another one that's not too hard. But when you start talking about not recognizing some intangibles, and therefore adding that back into goodwill, and thinking about what you're going to do with a bigger pot goodwill going forward, which affects impairment, that would be, and then what do you do with the people who have already recognised all those intangibles and are writing them off over a period? That would be quite a major change.
Oh, but or even reintroduction of amortisation.
It's also a major change.
That is a major change.
Operationally, but
conceptually, it's a major change.
Yeah, it's a major change, and it will upset a lot of people. Three years after you.
Lise was upset about it.
Coming from a very standard set of view, which of course is sort of legitimate, but not necessarily the best of all. IAS 36 and IAS 37 have been around now for 15 years, between 15 and 20 years. You've done a bit here and a bit there. Everyone's been avoiding doing anything to IAS 38 for a long time. A number of us have argued that it needs some work, but everyone's avoiding intangibles like the pest, so to speak. We all know why, and one cannot do this huge thing at some stage, but I don't think there is any way but looking at IAS 36, because again, it was the first thing in 1998, and 15 years, 17 years use of a first standard. Normally you would have done a peer on IAS 36 a number of years ago.
Roger?
I agree with Liesl, but also I'd say that I think business communication popular when it came in. I don't think the average standard to do a PIR on is going to produce this amount of comment. And I think we should just bite the bullet and say there are some aspects of business combinations which are just not popular, and perhaps this is the time to fix them.
Mm. I mean, Lisa raises another point. I mean, I think our process at the moment is to look at the new standards 3 years after they become applicable. But we're not even thinking about the old ones as far as PIR is concerned. Mm-hmm. Maybe when we do our agenda consultation next year, if people think we should be looking at some
of
these,
will hear it.
It would be the time to tell us.
Yeah. Okay. I think we. Liesl's intervention answered question two more or less. I think we talked about question three too. more generally the question of conversions with US GAAP. Well, our colleagues from the FSB already said that are waiting for us, which is much appreciated. And I think what we need to do is, when we are a little bit further in our work, that we have a deliberation on how to proceed with this, because my personal opinion is, I would be surprised if your opinion is different, that it is important that we stay converged on this converged or largely converged standard. Does anybody have a different opinion? Probably not. So we also have I just checked in our IFRS for SMEs, we also have a maximum amortization period of 10 years. That is very much, you know, the legitimation for that is very much, these are small preparers, impairment is too difficult for them. That is the trade-off there. And I suppose also with your counsel, private companies.
Our counsel picked 10, because IFRS for SMEs is 10. it's also greater than 9 and less than 11.
To apply IFRS for SMEs to the big companies, it's a big step. It's a big step. Okay, are there more issues to be discussed on this issue? I think it was a very interesting discussion. Okay.